Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with my co-host, John Wells. We decipher science and technology in an entertaining, amusing, and accessible way. If we can understand it, so can you. Today in the program, we'll talk with a contributing writer for Wired and New York Times Magazine, and also one of the people chosen to test the Google Glass. You know, John, those glasses that somehow you put them on and there's a computer screen up on one corner of it.
Christmas is right around the corner, Lynn.
That's right. So Clive Thompson will be our first guest, and he'll tell us all about testing the Google Glass and also about his new book called Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better.
And then we'll speak with Daniel Lieberman, who's the head of the Evolutionary Biology Department at Harvard University. He brilliantly illuminates the transformations and evolutions of the human body as it is adapted to its environment for over 6 million years in his book, The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. All that, plus today's cool story when we return. Don't touch that dial.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a nonprofit community hospital. Have you ever wondered how many calories you burn while you sleep, or how much your organs weigh, or how you can lower your healthcare costs and prevent many diseases? Live Well Center at Park City Medical Center has those answers and more. Whether you're hoping to lose weight or gain a competitive edge, Live Well Center can help. Make an appointment today for a healthy lifestyle evaluation, now covered by most insurance companies. Visit livewellcenter.org/PC for more information.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with my co-host John Wells. Well, what is technology really doing to our brains? Are we less focused, more distracted? Do we now only participate with fleeting glances of knowledge instead of engage in deep learning? Well, our first guest, Clive Thompson, says that the internet age gives us a new form of intelligence, one which our and that our cognitive and creative abilities are enhanced by machines. We learn more, we retain it longer, we write in new forms, even think in new ways. That's what he puts forth in his new book, Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Thompson is a contributing writer for Wired and New York Times Magazine, and he was chosen as a tester for the Google Glass, which we'll have him explain in just a moment. He says our long-standing pattern in response to new thinking tools is that first we freak out, but then we adapt. Clive Thompson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, first of all, I just have to ask you about the Google Glass. I mean, we've heard of this thing. We don't understand how we put on these glasses, and there's this little computer screen, and we say, okay, glass, take a video, or okay, glass, whatever. Tell us about your experience with that.
Sure, and it really is an interesting thing to try out. The first thing is that to note is that it's actually surprisingly comfortable when you put them on your head. They're very light; they don't really feel like they're in the way. The little computer screen that you look at, it's in front of your right eye, but it's actually raised up fairly high. So you actually have to sort of look upwards. It's not sort of in the way when you're looking at someone. And when you turn it on, it produces this little glowing screen, a little pink screen. Sort of looks like it looks to be about the size of like maybe if you held a smartphone in front of your eyes, maybe about a foot away is what it kind of looks like. And, you know, so you can use it to do Google searches. You can use it to take pictures. There's a camera on it. You can use it to search the web, I used it to look at Twitter at replies when people were at replying at me. You can text message and do email. There's a bunch of apps that they've come. You know, there's a mapping app, so you can use it for turn-by-turn directions. It's basically, yes, like having a little computer in the corner of your eye.
That is so wild. So obviously, if you're using Google Maps on it, that is to say you're using it while you're driving.
Oh, actually, yeah, you know, you could. Now, they encourage you not to. But the truth is, I actually experimented with that. I said, what the heck, let's try this. And I would have to say that I actually found it easier to glance at than looking down at my GPS.
I found it
probably was slightly less distracting. I also tried it on my bike, which is pretty funny. I think I found it a little more distracting then, because with your bike, you're really, you're very exposed. You really don't want anything in the way. After I tried that, I thought, no, this is not a good idea. I should not do this again, basically. But I did talk to a lot of people. I might be an outlier there. I interviewed about 20 or 24 people that were using Google Glass, and several of them said they actually liked using it on their bike, because they could send text messages back and forth, because it's voice controlled. You don't type into it, you just talk, and it appears there. So,
wow. You were one of how many people who applied to be a tester?
Oh, there were several thousand, actually. I'm not sure how many. There was probably tens of thousands of people that asked, and they handed out a few thousand. So there's not very many yet. Although they say they're going to put them on sale, you know, relatively soon. Their prediction originally was early 2014. So if they keep to that, if you want to get one, you can try it out. I mean, it was interesting. I found it in some respects. I found it there wasn't really anything I could do with it that I couldn't do with just as easily with my phone yet. You know, there's sort of an application problem. No one has really designed anything that you can do with it that is so different and interesting that I think you'd want to have it on every day, or put it this way, something so interesting and amazing that you're willing to look like a bit of a dork walking around with this thing on your head. You know, that's what they have to do.
But that's not, where not we're all leading into dorkdom, if that's a word.
Possibly.
Clive, there's a little bit of pushback as people talk about technology and how that may be making us less social or less connected, or we're not able to communicate as well, those sorts of things. And going back historically, and you certainly provide great arguments for this with the printing press, telegraph, with the telephone, with the radio, there's always been pushback for these breakaway technologies, hasn't there?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I was in one sense, you know, we can regard the record of history as somewhat comforting, because every time there's a new media that comes along that changes the way that we communicate with other people and the way that we communicate with ourselves, you know, the way we sort of set down our thoughts, there tends to be like a deep concern that this is going to alter some primary aspects of what makes us human, because, you know, the act of communicating is really such a primal human aspect. So, you know, writing came along and, you know, Socrates worried that it would spell the demise of memory, that if we wrote things down, there would never be any knowledge in our heads anymore. And he was sort of right, and this is the typical pattern, is that each of the concerns, they're not crazy. Like, they're often accurate about some things, but they tend to fail to foresee the very interesting new forms of thinking that will emerge as that technology matures. So Socrates is right. You know, nobody can recite, you know, hundreds of lines of poetry anymore. We sort of stopped needing to memorize everything. But we have this secondary ability, which is that we can collect vast amounts of knowledge and, you know, sort of re-encounter it over and over again in these things called, you know, books or post-it notes or papers. And that allows us to sort of diversify and massively expand the amount of knowledge that we can ponder. So he accurately saw some of the bad, but he failed to foresee the good.
And unfortunately, because of that, we don't know very much about Socrates.
it was ironic that the only reason we know anything about him at all is that his student Plato wrote down his version of all these dialogues. Right. So had writing not come along, no one would even know that Socrates ever existed.
So let's go to the new millennium and tackle some of these myths. Because of tools like texting and Twitter, most of us, you know, especially school-aged children and teens, you know, the myth is that they're less literate, they're worse at writing than they were before these technologies existed. Can you tackle that one?
Sure. I mean, on the one hand, when you look at kids using, you know, like funny short forms in text messages or in chat, you know, you can sort of, you'll stand on the shoulder and look at it and you can think, oh my goodness, we're seeing the demise of literate civilization, you know, unfolding in front of our eyes. But the truth is, you know, most kids are fairly adept at code switching. They know that this is something that they're doing, that's a casual language, a funny language, a playful language. And in fact, actually studies of texting and all those short forms have found that they're actually quite linguistically sophisticated. They actually take an awful lot of work to do. Like they take work to create and work to unpack. And more hearteningly, they don't seem to be actually infecting and degrading the way that kids are actually writing. Andrea Lunsford, Stanford professor, did a wonderful survey of 100 years of freshman comp essays and found not only were there almost no incidents of these sort of short forms in the papers, but the papers had actually exploded in length and complexity over the 100 years. They were 6 times longer, and they had gone from being these really simple kind of a paragraph about what I did, you know, on my summer vacation, or you know, description of a flower. You know, that was the state of the art of a freshman comp essay in 1917. The ones in 2006 were these, you know, these long 1,200 word arguments where the students were saying, here is my point I'm going to make. Here's the evidence I have. Here's my conclusions from it. It was startlingly more complicated. So it doesn't appear. And you know, in fact, actually, you can look at that explosion of complexity, and it's a technological story too, right? I mean, the reason why they're longer is because it's easier to write now. You go back in 1917, you try writing with one of those nib pens. I mean, it was an arduous process. So you get the ballpoint pen, and we go faster. You get the computer, and you know we can compose more fluently. And then you get resources like the internet that allow students to sort of do research. You know, they have to be taught how to do it well. You know, it's not an innate skill, but if they're taught how to do it well, you know, it vastly opens up the amount of stuff that they can contemplate. And this is where you get this explosion in the quality of the freshman comp essay.
That, you know, that's so heartening to hear, especially as a parent, you know, but that leads us into the next thing that most parents worry about with this age of technology is that, you know, we'll be sitting at the dinner table and our 15-year-old is looking down at his phone and tweeting and Instagramming and, you know, the social aspect. But you kind of bust that myth, too. You say that technology does make us more social in certain ways.
It certainly can. Yeah, I mean, I think it makes us more social in really weird and interesting ways. I mean, I'll begin by saying if your kid is sitting there texting at the dinner table, you should probably just take their phone away. I mean, for goodness sakes, we need
and throw
to
it out the window.
Yeah, and throw it at the window or dump it in a bucket of water. You know, like nothing I'm saying here obviates the need for basic civil behavior, right? You know. And I'm sort of heartened to see a lot of adults actually starting to sort of realize that they're being dorks, you know, to each other.
Yeah.
My book is about cognition, but it doesn't preclude terrible behavior. Smart people can behave horribly, right? The thing about social activity. Well, first off, is that many studies have found that teenagers, the ones that actually are most avid users of social media, are also most avid face-to-face hangers out with their friends. They're just, sociality begets sociality, whether it's online or off. It doesn't replace it, thankfully. But the more interesting stuff happens when you think about, well, what does it mean for the caliber of our everyday thought when we can actually reach out and contact other people this way, you know, and contact not just people we know, but interesting strangers, you know, via tools that are more open-ended, like Twitter, which, you know, some but not all teenagers use. You know, this is a massive migration in a very cool way to what I call public thinking, you know, the movement from a period before the internet where you walked around with a lot of thoughts in your head, and you had almost no one really to share them with. You had no way to set them down and publish them. And the last 10 years, we have just completely transformed the fact that we can now, if you're wondering about something, if you have a funny joke to tell, if you have a question, if you have an obsession, you can find the other people that are obsessed with that and go deep with them. And this is a really big deal. I think it's often hard for journalists to understand how huge a deal this is, because we always spent our time, you know, writing our ideas down and getting feedback from readers. But this is a brand new thing in the lives of the vast majority of people. And as I wrote my book, I kept on hearing these stories about how delighted people were that their intellectual isolation had gone away, that they were able, when they were wondering about something, when they were thinking through a problem, they could hook up with like-minded people, and how transformative this was.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Clive Thompson. He's the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better.
Clive, let's go through another myth, and that is our reliance on Google for finding answers makes us stupider and less able to think independently. Can you talk about that?
Sure. You know, on the one hand, this was something that genuinely worried me when I started the research in my book. I mean, I was one of those people who was sort of alarmed to discover that I couldn't really, you know, remember phone numbers anymore. Mm-hmm. They're all stored in my phone. I'd lost the habit of it. And I thought, well, is that some sort of metonym for my overall brain function? You know, is it the beginning of the end, you know? But the more that I talk to brain researchers, the more I realize that the truth is our brains have always been terrible at remembering details. But the good thing is they're very good at retaining meaning, you know? So you know, you read a story in the paper that, you know, talks about drone strikes in Pakistan, and you read a lot about how people in, you know, areas of Waziristan really hate it. You know, a day or two later, you're not going to remember those specific details. You will have solidified the schematic understanding you have that drone strikes are really annoying people in Pakistan. And so, if you need, you know, when you need to refresh yourself on that, there's a bunch of things you do. One is, you know, maybe in the old days you'd go and look at your encyclopedia. Although the truth is, we didn't do that very often. Encyclopedia Britannica did a study of its own users and found people open their encyclopedias on average once a year. And that's because it's kind of a pain in the butt to do so. So we tend to go with our bad in-brain knowledge. And the faster way to get a fact turns out to be to talk to a person, right? We have this thing called transactive memory that goes back, you know, millennia, that we actually store a huge amount of our knowledge in other people. You know, you see this if you're in a long-term relationship or a marriage, you've seen this. You know, you realize that your spouse is really good at remembering X, Y, and Z, and you're really good at A, B, and C. So
yeah.
The two of you lie to each other all the time. It's like, where do you put where are the tax forms for this? Whose birthday is that? Where's the thing that does the thing? You know, like, you know, what's the capital of Pakistan? And so people not only think collaboratively, they remember collaboratively. And the good news is, like, this is a significant cognitive booster. Study after study finds that when people remember collaboratively as a group, they are enormously smarter than the pieces put together. You essentially get a whole that is larger than the sum of its parts. They're better at analyzing. They're better at doing tasks. And so what we're doing with Google and things like that is we're just fitting them into this long-standing transactive relationship. We now have, you know, I've got my wife, I've got my friends that know smart things, and now I've got this sort of, you know, very memorious thing that's riding around with me in my pocket that has whole other stores of knowledge that I can peck into. And so, you know, the more I talk, the more I learn about this, the more it calmed me down, because I realized we are just fitting these tools into these fantastic forms of social thinking that we've had for hundreds and thousands of years.
And I think your book makes a fascinating point as you talk about Big Blue, which is the IBM mainframe. It used to be chess master versus the computer, and we certainly went through all the iterations there. But then you start talking about the collaboration between maybe not a chess master, but someone that knows, you know, that has some skills in chess along with a computer, and how much stronger they are through that collaboration. And that really helps to make the point.
Yeah, I was fascinated by this. I didn't know the story. So 1997, you know, Deep Blue completely kills Kasparov, the best chess player at chess. And everyone thinks, oh my goodness, chess is over, that's it. You know, if a machine can play better than a human, why would we remain interested in the game, right? But Kasparov was, you know, he's a smart guy. He knew that sooner or later a computer was going to win, because it was working just with brute force. You know, it's humans... We have this very, you know, fuzzy intuition, wisdom-based understanding of the game. A computer is just basically calculating eight moves out, find the best move, go with that. And if you get, once you get eight moves out, you're going to beat the humans. So, but the humans and computers think in very different ways. And Kasparov, who's a smart guy, realized, well, what if rather than compete, we actually had those two different forms of thought collaborate? And so he invented this thing called advanced chess, where a grandmaster would sit down with a laptop and fight a grandmaster with a laptop. And so, you know, he sat down with another grandmaster. Each of them could program the chess pieces where they were sitting into the computer and find out what the chess software would recommend or think was the best move. They could merge that with their own deep human intuition, and they began playing chess on a level that had never been seen before. Like they were using these creative gambits that were so complicated and so fantastic and creative that people were literally gasping as they watched this match unfold. And then later on, he started, you know, holding matches where anyone could play. And it turned out that the real winners were not necessarily the grandmasters. They were more like chess neophytes who were just really good at understanding how to use the computer, you know, when to accept the recommendation and when to say, no, I'm going to go with a uniquely human psychological play here. You know, they got the idea that humans are good at a certain type of thinking, computers are good at another, and the trick is to be able to learn which one you should rely on in what situation. Those people were absolutely dominant. They were fantastic at chess, better than anyone else. And I think this is sort of really, in some respects, what we're doing today. You know, we're learning what are the things that that our isolated brains are really good at doing. What are the times when we should be, you know, using things like Google? What are the times when we should be thinking quietly to ourselves, and what are the times that we should be talking and broadcasting our stuff on, you know, on Twitter or Facebook and getting that social thinking. This is a new palette of human thought that's opened up to us.
So, Clive, let me make a little leap here and tell me if you think this works. And that is, if you're in a business negotiation, if you're developing a product, if you are trying to work out a complex problem with a bunch of people, you don't have to be the smartest person in the room, but you need to be the person that can collaborate with technology.
Yeah, that's right. And use that technology to collaborate with other people, to find answers, to find people to bonk things up against, and even to harness the sort of interesting transformations of our thought that happen when we realize that we're going to start talking publicly about a problem. Like, this is one of the things I found was really interesting. You know, we like to think that we're just sitting here chatting online and whatnot, and it's all kind of, you know, narcissistic or whatnot. But the truth is, every time we sit down to utter something to someone else, whether that's an email or a tweet or a Tumblr post or whatnot, it challenges us to sort of think more deeply about what we're doing, because we're now going before an audience. And even an audience of one person, studies show, forces us to clarify what we're thinking about. You know, I sort of sit at my desk and I'm thinking of things and I'm doing a lot of hand waving. I think I've got this figured out. But the moment I try and describe what I'm thinking to someone else, whether that's, again, in a tweet or in an email or on a blog post, suddenly my thinking gets way sharper and I realize, oh, I don't know what the heck I'm talking. I gotta go back to square one on this one. And that act of moving from intellectual isolation to an audience is a really big deal, and it's happening all the time, over and over. I think it's one of the most fascinating and quotidian and everyday aspects of the way that we interact with technology.
Now, you know, we're learning more and more about how the plasticity of our brains. Neuroscientists are coming up with this. It's way more plastic than we think. But I'm wondering about the gap between the generations. I mean, as we go forward, everyone's going to be a digital native, right? But right now, you know, I'm a digital immigrant. And then I'm looking at the gap between even the way my thinking has evolved and my mom, who doesn't use any technology, essentially. And I think this is a big part of the argument you're making in your book, is that there is a gap. We are thinking in much different ways. And how is that going to affect our culture right now when we're not all on the same level of technology?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, it's hard for me to cast forward too far. I mean, one of the things with my book is I was trying to describe the present, because I find that predicting the future is not only like Yogi Berra said, you know, predicting is hard, especially the future. And frankly, often our most confident predictions get so many things so wrong. We often fail to see the little things that are going to be much more transformative in the future, because we're focused on the small, short-term changes. And I may be guilty of that in my book. It's hard to say. I think that there's two observations I'd make about generational change. One is that one of the big differences is, because we have the ability to think more in public, and again, at the level of an audience of one, an email to someone else or a message to someone else in chat, to an audience of potentially millions if you're doing it on a very public platform, I think that is going to continue to move forward as something that is enormously powerful, but something we also need to learn when not to do. Like, one of the things that I see teachers doing that I think is very smart in the best schools is they're getting kids to really engage in something that's hard. It's metacognition. Mm-hmm. When should you the all the kids, they're very fluent with, you know, the idea of speaking for a public. That's second nature to them. But they need to be taught to think about what are the situations in which that's not a good idea. It's better to do the classic Rodin thinker thing. Sit there, you know, with your chin on your fist, you know, read a book and go for a long walk. Really, this is what I call cognitive diversity. And I think that actually that's going to be the challenge going forward is getting people to think about their thinking. We are not traditionally conditioned to do this. Because we haven't had a whole welter of ways to conduct our thinking. So that's the first thing I would say is that there's going to be a challenge to understand and teach formally, what these new modes of thinking entail. The second thing, though, I suppose, is that in a way, I think the changes may be smaller than we might imagine. I mean, I once commissioned an article. I was an editor back in 1996 or something, and I was asking the writer to predict what the world would be like 30 years from now. And she wrote a very funny response because she basically said, "Well, you know, let's think about what it was like 30 years ago." And she imagined a scene on a subway. And her point was that the vast majority of things people were doing are fairly similar to what they are today. Are we falling in love and listening to music and you know, sort of worrying about what people think of us and, you know, trying to make more money? All these things are very similar. Like, the basic human nature actually is fairly robust and resistant to massive change. The modes of thinking are going to continue to evolve, but probably what's going to happen is I think we can hopefully say that 50 years from now we will not be a completely weird race of unrecognizable aliens with big heads and huge eyes and UFOs. We'll see about that. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'll be here 50 years from now. You know, whoever is 10 years old listening to this, you know, please hold me to my word on that. I think the changes will seem huge in the short run, and then maybe a little less epical when we look at it from the far, far future.
Our guest, Clive Thompson, is a contributing writer to Wired and New York Times Magazine, and his book, Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better, is a fantastic read. And Clive, thanks so much for your time today.
I had a great time. It was a great conversation.
Best of luck to you, Clive.
Thanks a lot.
And you're listening to Cool Science Radio. That was fun. I heard him on an NPR program, and I knew we had to talk to him.
Yeah.
And this is really a good book to pass on to to my parents.
That's it.
Open their minds. All right. This is Cool Science Radio. We'll be right back with Daniel Lieberman. He's written a book on the evolution of the human body. It's fascinating. Stay with us.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves Chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly at 5:30 p.m. You can contact us at 649-3140. Our website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. One of the great paradoxes of the evolution of the human body is that we live longer than we have ever before, but we certainly have far more amounts of chronic disease. Our next guest, Daniel Lieberman, is the chair of the Evolutionary Biology Department at Harvard University, and he explores this evolution and even disevolution of the human body in an unprecedented way. From the rise of bipedalism to our superlative endurance athleticism, the last 6 million years or so, our bodies is brilliantly captured in Lieberman's new book, The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. Daniel's now joining us by phone. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. And a major theme of your book, possibly the central premise of the book, is the reason we fail to prevent preventable disease is because we, society, does not pay attention to human evolution. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, that is indeed my major theme, and that's because our bodies are the way they are because of a long
chain of evolutionary events, and evolution is not a very simple story. It's a complex story, and it results in a very tangled sort of set of adaptations in our bodies. But paying attention to them is important because evolution explains why our bodies are the way they are, and evolution explains why our bodies are changing today, not just because of biological evolution, but also because of another form of evolution, cultural evolution, which is happening much more rapidly than natural selection.
Okay, let's just talk about arterial sclerosis. I'd like to say that you provide probably one of the best explanations of this disease that I've ever heard. You've got maybe 12 or 15 pages towards the latter part of the book, and I think I, for the first time, really understand it. So let me ask you a couple of questions. One is ancient mummies whose hearts and vessels were CT scanned, you know, the three-dimensional X-ray, revealed that they also had a hardening of the arteries, but it was at least 50% less than in today's Western populations. And because of physical inactivity, poor diet, obesity, drinking, smoking, emotional stress, the things that we certainly embrace today, we've brought arterial sclerosis to a level where death by heart attacks and strokes in an aging population is more common than it has ever been.
Yeah, it's the number one killer of Americans today, part of this interesting transition that we're going through, this paradox that you mentioned, is that yes, we are living longer, and we are actually healthier than we probably ever were before. But there's a trade-off, everybody has to die of something, and there's no question that as everybody ages, your arteries harden, etc. And so it's not surprising that you expect hunter-gatherers who lived a long time in the past to also have arterial hardening, and they probably had an increase in blood pressure as they aged. The problem is that we're exacerbating these processes and adding new problems through physical inactivity and diet in ways that our bodies really aren't very well able to handle. So people getting serious atherosclerosis in their 50s and 60s and very low through low fitness and through diet is a really a novel condition, what we call a mismatch condition. It's really from our bodies being poorly adapted to the modern environment.
And there's a lot written on this subject. I wanted to get your opinion. How inelastic is the human cardiovascular system? Can an aging population that eliminates some of those risk factors I mentioned earlier, can it reverse arterial sclerosis?
Well, it's as I said before, it's natural to have to lose some elasticity as you age. That's an inevitable consequence of age. We're not going to be able to defeat aging completely. What happens, though, is that, for example, as plaques fill the form in our arteries, we hasten that process enormously and also raise blood pressure and cause other damages, particularly if that occurs in, say, the coronary arteries that feed the heart. So, we know from extensive evidence that that what you eat and how much you exercise has enormous effects on preventing cardiovascular disease, and that's not by accident. It's because our bodies evolved to be very active, and we evolved to eat certain kinds of diets, and we just never evolved to cope with the kinds of production of fat that we produce in our bodies. So even if you eat fat-free foods, like there are all kinds of foods out there in the supermarket that are labeled fat-free, but your body just converts them into fat anyway. And we're not very well able to cope with, for example, processed foods that are very high in sugar and very high in carbohydrate that are in the absence of fiber. And the result is we get a lot of central adiposity, belly fat. And then that ends up basically in our arteries. So we can seriously reduce the risks of heart disease. Through diet and exercise. And of course, we've known that all along. But what I'm trying to argue is that these explanations have an important evolutionary basis.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Daniel Lieberman. He's the author of The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. And Daniel, I have to say, just before we got you on the phone, we were speaking with Clive Thompson. He wrote a book called Smarter Than You Think about how technology is changing our minds for the better. And I don't know if you're familiar with it, but what he says is, you know, sort of, he talks about the evolution of our brains and how our brains are, you know, we're starting to think in different ways because of evolution. He made this funny comment that, you know, I asked him to predict something in the future, and he said, well, you know, we're not going to end up with these huge heads and looking like aliens and that sort of thing. And I kind of chuckled because that's exactly what has happened to us, I know, from looking at your book. And so talk about that a little bit, about, I was interested in what has happened to our brains and therefore our heads. I mean, these huge heads, and how has that evolved?
Well, big brains evolved a long time ago, actually. We actually don't have brains that are any larger than, for example, Neanderthals. In fact, brains have shrunk a little bit since the Ice Age. Just bodies got smaller, brains got a little bit smaller as well. So big brains really evolved a few hundred thousand years ago, before even our species evolved, and they've remained essentially fairly large, and as I said, shrunk just a wee bit. But the real acceleration of brain size increases happened around 2.5 million years ago when we became hunter-gatherers and started to hunt and cooperate, and do all kinds of, use tools and process our food and do all kinds of things differently that gave us more energy, which released a constraint to enable us to grow bigger brains. But you know, it's interesting, you know, why do we have those brains? Well, you know, ultimately what natural selection cares about is how many offspring you have who survive and reproduce. And so selection for big brains is really, again, driven by selection for reproductive success. And I think one of the things that I worry about, and there's a section in my book about brains versus brawn, is that we have this kind of myth in our society that, and I think it's often propagated in science, that somehow human evolution is the triumph of brains over brawn, and you know, and we're now using technology to make our brains even better. But you know, we're still stuck with the same bodies that we had. There are a lot of diseases that we've been able to conquer that are diseases often caused by infectious diseases, right? So they're, you know, we can identify a microbe and kill it. The problem with a lot of the non-infectious diseases that we're struggling with, that are costing us so much money and causing so much misery, is that they have very complex origins from multiple genes, and most of those genes have very small effects. And there are going to be no simple magic bullet solutions to any of those diseases. We're stuck with the bodies that we have, and we shouldn't sit around waiting until scientists in white lab coats come around to fix those diseases, because we actually already know how to prevent them. Evolution gives us, and other branches of biology give us plenty of information about what to do about these diseases, but we have to stop this vicious cycle that we've created by treating the symptoms of these diseases rather than their causes.
Right. And so, you know, your argument is that certain things evolve and other things don't. I mean, it's definitely not very evolved to treat symptoms instead of causes.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if in your book, as you're writing along, you're noticing that certain things evolve and other things come full circle. And a couple examples would be, you know, now we're starting to eat these paleo diets. That's come full circle. And then you're a big advocate of barefoot running. I know you got this ringing endorsement from Christopher McDougall who wrote Born to Run. So we used to barefoot run. Now we're going back to it.
Yeah, I think people are really interested in how their bodies evolved, and there's a lot of an interest in low carb diets and in paying attention to evolution. I think we have to be very thoughtful though how we do it. Actually, I enjoy barefoot running, but what I actually think is more important is how you run rather than what's on your feet. So I sometimes get misquoted in that regard. I'm not a total fan of the paleo diet. I think there's much truth to it, but I think, you know, there's also a lot of good things about the world today. We have to be thoughtful about how we apply the lessons of evolution. So, you know, for example, evolution since the age of farming has made some of us able to digest milk. That doesn't mean just because our ancestors didn't drink milk as adults doesn't mean we shouldn't, or not eat legumes or cereals, as some people of the paleo diet are advocate. I mean, that's just not feasible. You know, we have to feed 7 billion people on this planet. We're not going to feed them all on grass-fed beef. So we need to be very thoughtful and careful about how we apply the lessons of evolution. I think one of the most important ones is that we didn't evolve to be healthy. We evolved to have lots of offspring.
That's right.
And evolution only cares about health insofar as it helps us, our ancestors, have more offspring. So, you know, barefoot running is not a solution in and of itself. It's no panacea, just as, you know, eating as much, you know, grass-fed beef is a panacea as well. We need to be thoughtful and careful about how we think about the concept of adaptation and how we apply it to our bodies. No simple answers, sorry.
What's amazing to me is that we have these Stone Age bodies, and we're certainly living in the modern world. And evolution has marched on very quietly. It's been very quiet, very deliberate. It takes so long for these changes to take place. And yet, you point out a couple of examples where our lifestyle has changed dramatically in short periods of time that have really altered our health. For an example, since 1850, you talk about the mortality rate going from roughly 22% to 0.6%, and of course, how much longer we're living today. But can you talk about some of the things just in the last 40 years since 1970, like, for an example, the amount of sleep that we get? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, there are different kinds of evolution. Biological evolution is what we often think about, but cultural evolution, another form of evolution. It's change over time, and we transmit it not just from parents to offspring, but from each other. This is an example of cultural transmission right now as we're talking, and it's transformed our lives dramatically. So late night, you know, TV and lights and the way we sleep has changed. So people are getting less sleep than they used to, and people are getting less physical activity. I mean, think about, you know, my day. I can, you know, take a car to work, take an elevator to my floor and sit in a chair all day long and never get my heart rate up. That's a very novel thing. And so all of these shifts in our environment that are caused by cultural change, some of it really rapid, really recent, is transformative. But just as a simple example, you know, it used to be when the sewing machine was invented, it used to be pedal-driven. My grandmother had one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And then they invented the electric sewing machine. Well, that changes the cost, the number of calories you spend per hour, by about 15 calories per hour, just to put an electric motor on that. Well, if you were a seamstress or, you know, working in a shop and, you know, working 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, you know, 50 weeks a year, that 15 calorie an hour difference adds up to like something like 50,000 calories a year, which is enough energy to run, you know, 18 marathons. You keep adding up all these different little effects. The estimates are that today we're spending about 300 to 500 calories less per day on physical activity. Now, talk about a dramatic shift in our biology caused by, you know, by culture. I mean, that's an enormous one. We're sleeping less. We're eating foods that are different, and these, of course, are affecting our bodies in all kinds of fascinating ways. Some good, some bad.
What is the difference in the office worker that sits behind a desk and the factory worker that works on an assembly line as far as their calorie output?
Well, it's enormously different. I don't know the exact numbers because, of course, it really different jobs really vary. But early factory workers did actually have fairly arduous jobs. There's a simple measure of work called the physical activity level, or a PAL, and it's just the ratio of energy you spend every day, the total amount of energy you spend versus the energy you'd spend if you were doing nothing, like lying in bed and watching TV all day. And modern sedentary office workers can have physical activity levels about 1.5 or about 1.6, whereas factory workers can have physical activity levels about 1.7 or 1.8. That's actually a substantial difference. Again, it's amounting to, you know, many hundreds of calories a day. And some factory jobs are incredibly arduous, as hard as working in the field. So post-industrial life has really been a very transformative effect on the human body.
So is it that period of time that you have seen over, you know, the last 6 million years or so that really was the fastest evolution in terms of the human body, the whole what the Industrial Revolution did for us?
Well, I mean, there's two different kinds of evolution. There's natural selection.
So yeah.
The changes, the genetic shifts in our body have been small since the Industrial Revolution. It's only been 10 generations,
yeah,
really, since the Industrial Revolution started. But the environment in which our bodies exist has changed incredibly rapidly in the last few generations, way more rapidly than any other time in human history. Even the introduction of farming, which of course also changed our bodies dramatically, you know, it didn't happen at the same breakneck speed that the Industrial Revolution had. So we are undergoing a very rapid environmental transformation in the way we, you know, for our bodies, and that of course is affecting us in all kinds of ways. And again, some good, some bad. I mean, antibiotics, refrigeration, sterilization, sanitation, all of these things have led to incredible improvements in human life. But processed food and physical inactivity, lack of sleep, increased stress have led to costs. And the question is, are these necessary byproducts? Are these costs necessarily tied to the benefits that we have? And I would argue that they're not necessary, and that we can actually try to live modern lives, but also try to decrease those costs.
You know, something I found very interesting in your book, and I want to ask you about life expectancy, because I think that it has in the last couple of years been the first time that life expectancy has shortened, at least I think for men. Is that right?
There's some hints of it. There's some evidence that today's kids being born today in America may have a lower life expectancy than their parents, and that's a really recent shift, and a very frightening one. And of course, that's because of the concerns we have today over
obesity
and fitness. I actually think that we spend we spend insufficient time worrying about fitness. They're both important. But you know, our children growing up today are physically inactive, and they're eating foods that promote obesity. And the combination of the two means that there's a reasonable expectation that life expectancy will be decreased.
Yeah, that's
under current conditions.
That's part of that disevolution or that full circle thing that you talk about.
But I think we spend too much time worrying about life expectancy and not enough time about morbidity or illness. So you know, if you measure the quality of life, as people live longer, they're also, you know, many of those years are healthy, but not all of those years are healthy, and there's a ratio there. And so what's happening is that as people are living longer, they're also we're getting what's called an extension of morbidity. People are also ill for longer, and they're suffering from chronic diseases that last many, many years that didn't used to decrease the quality of life. And so I think while we should think about mortality, we should even think more strongly about quality of life. And that's, of course, related to cost. I mean, you know, cost, I think the estimates are it costs something like, on average, I mean, numbers vary, but, you know, at least $20,000 a year more to pay for the healthcare costs of somebody who has heart disease per year. That's a lot of extra money. And you multiply that, if you realize that a third of Americans have this problem, we're talking, you know, that's a major reason why our healthcare crisis is occurring today. It's because we're paying an enormous amount of money. Maybe we shouldn't be paying as much as we are, but we nonetheless have to give an enormous amount of healthcare to people for a disease that is to a large extent preventable.
Professor Lieberman, we've spoken about obesity and lack of physical activity and the types of foods that we're eating, those sorts of things. Are there any other cultural behaviors that you've observed that the jury is out on, we haven't actually seen the results of yet, that possibly concern you?
Oh, gosh. That's a hard one to answer. I'm not sure. I mean, there's certainly, again, everything has trade-offs. There are benefits and costs to everything that we do. And I think, for example, we don't know a lot about some of the pollutants in our environment, just how much of a problem they are. We don't know a lot about you know, some of the shifts in nutrition and how much they're you know, what the exact effects are on health. And that part of that's because most of the diseases that we're interested in are very complex diseases. And they have they're involved in many, many genes and many environmental factors. I mean, autism is a good example, right? Mm-hmm. We still don't really know the causes of autism, but it's certainly on the rise. Antibiotics, again, complex, because obviously antibiotics save lives, but also the overuse of antibiotics can also cause problems and may be implicated in the rise in asthma and allergies and some autoimmune diseases. Now, how do we balance those That's a very complicated question to answer.
Daniel, before we let you go, a quick question. As you're teaching at Harvard, what are students, when you teach this stuff, what most concerns them, or what's most on the forefront and on their radar for about this?
Well, you know, it's wonderful to teach students because they're so passionate and interested and excited, and I think a lot of them are really interested in public health. I mean, a lot of them understand that they're concerned by the fact that they're growing up in a society that is caught in this sort of vicious cycle, and that you know, what can we do to halt this and to improve the world and to make it a better place for not just themselves but for others. And so that's actually something that gives me a lot of optimism.
Yeah. You know,
future doctors are really, I think they understand that preventive medicine really is the best form of medicine, and I think that's where we really need to focus a lot of our energies. You know, we know how to prevent a lot of these diseases. The question is, how as a society can we do that? That's a very difficult question to answer, but it's something that we need to tackle collectively.
Professor Daniel Lieberman, who's the head of Evolutionary Biology Department at Harvard University, has written a fascinating book, The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. Daniel, thank you for being on our show this morning.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Are you a
Red Sox fan?
Oh, I mean, impossible to live in Boston and not be a Red Sox.
Yeah, very passionate about sports in that town.
He asked everyone, Daniel, from Boston that we talked to.
Well, I used to live in the Back Bay, and it was a tough game last night.
Good. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Okay, we will be back after these words from our underwriters, and we'll be talking about today's cool story. Stay tuned.
You're invited to Fun Friday Fall Fest every Friday at 9 a.m., where John and Jan poke a fun at the myriad of merriment to be had this fall.
Join us for our candy countdown.
Call in to win our candy quiz.
Fall Fest, Friday Fest.
October Fest. Brought to you by Wasatch Pub and Squatters Pub and Brewery.
All Seasons Adventures.
Zermatt Resort and Spa.
Homestead Resort.
And Foothill Oriental Road.
John, get out of the candy.
Many know that Botox can help with migraines, but don't know where to turn for qualified headache care. Locally, Dr. Andy Talbot can help ease the life-altering headaches with Botox treatment. Park City Spine and Pain Clinic is an Intermountain healthcare facility with highly skilled pain management providers. If migraines are a concern, they can help at 435-658-7470. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Well, we talked a lot about technology earlier in the show, and just found this great article about the artist Banksy. I've seen him over the news recently in the last couple of days, and it was because of this YouTube video that went viral about Banksy's art in being sold on the street in New York City with this guy. It was like an experiment, or it was a prank. As we know, the graffiti artist Banksy, his quote-unquote pranks are his pieces of art that sell for, you know, what, $150,000, $170,000, $200,000. Little pieces of spray paint were being, of his art, we think, his art, being sold for what?
$150.
Yeah.
And they usually go for $60 a piece, and they typically sell between $150,000 and $750,000.
How about that? And the thing here was about the technology connection is that
right.
Even Banksy has an Instagram account, and he links to YouTube. Even that, he goes rogue, but not so rogue that he doesn't embrace technology.
You know, I'm curious. Is he like Sasquatch, where no one's ever really there've been reported sightings? Does anybody know what this guy looks like?
No. Well, I'm sure people do. The guy who interviewed him for the Sundance film, he was a protagonist, and he knows what he looks like. I don't really know who does, though, but it's interesting. You know, we've got the over at the Wall of the Java Cow,
right.
A Banksy preserved.
Sasquatch doesn't have a Facebook account.
No. Instagram, though, perhaps.
Possibly.
Well, you've been listening to Cool Science Radio, and I'm your host, Lynn Ware Peak, along with John Wells. We'll be back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional, FHA, and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
And thank also our underwriters, San Francisco Design and Prudential Utah Real Estate. Here's NPR News. You're listening to KPCW Park City.